Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
When did it begin for you, and what are some of the sort of obstacles you faced on your own personal journey that have led you to this work?
Yeah, well, I think for me to actually become a family mediator with an interest in trauma, it was almost like a series of events that sort of led me into this direction, because originally I really wanted to be a family lawyer. And that's, you know, I studied law and, you know, was sort of, you know, I guess determined to you know, graduate and be a lawyer or a solicitor, as we call it here. And it's sort of a case of pursuing what I thought I wanted and then finding out it's not for me, but, you know, getting into something else. And it was during my last few months in legal training where there was a compulsory mediation component. And I already had cemented in my mind I wanted to work in family law. So the topic was already there. It was just how. And so doing this compulsory mediation component, it was the first time that I felt that I could do it and that it really suited my personality and also my strengths, because I found that the way that the legal system worked and what it called for, it really needed, it was sort of highlighting my weaknesses. That makes sense. So I kind of knew I could do it, but I might not be any good at it. But then mediation came along as an alternative. And then I started pursuing, you know, that area. And once I started, I had, you know, finished the study and started working, I thought it only made sense for me to then become a couples counselor and family therapist. And so once I started to look at the therapy side of working with families and couples, then it was more evident that there was trauma seeped in, you know, all our thoughts, feelings and actions and the way that we respond generally. So it was just from there that I started pursuing anything and everything that I could, whether or not it was going to conferences or workshops or reading books and lectures and mixing a lot with a lot of counsellors and psychologists as well. Because I was often the only mediator or the only legal person in the room wherever I was. But then it really highlighted to me how the world needs to be more trauma-informed and where it's lacked, because I kind of, you know, saw what's needing by finding out what's missing.
That's an awesome journey in terms of, like, the more I have these conversations, the more I realize we're far more alike than we are different. And this process of, like, kind of going into things and then realizing that they're not sort of aligned in some ways, but for you it's cool in that you sort of streamline that down bit by bit and found like an intersection between the stuff you were doing and then moved bit by bit into these other fields that were much more much more important to you. And then to have like that final discovery is pretty cool. So going from there, you talk a bit about strength, a kind of strength based approach to life and adversity. I really like the kind of positive frame in that, like, you know, how we respond to things. What's that philosophy about for you?
Well, I guess I can link it into when I first started working as a family mediator in a government-funded centre with an organisation who really prided themselves on a strengths-based approach. And so it was really interesting for me because before that, I had worked in either government or private, where it was quite competitive and it was more about highlighting individuals' faults that needed to be improved on. So when I, you know, got this first job as a family mediator, my strengths were constantly highlighted, encouraged, and supported. So I was given cases that really supported my character and my strengths and the way that I work. And so it was interesting for me because I had studied a strengths-based approach as a mediator, mm-hmm. but then it wasn't until I was in this role and I actually felt it. And my personality's not so much that it changed, but I just became a lot more confident with myself or comfortable with myself, because I guess I was giving evidence. I was continually shown evidence of my strengths.
Mm.
And then that, you know, built up my sense of self and my self-esteem. So I kind of thought, oh, this method actually works. And then the more that I was sort of treated in that way, then it became easier for me to then relay that onto my clients and work in a strengths-based way with them. And then after, you know, years of practice, what I started to see that there were trends in the way that people manage adversity, and that if you were able to view your situation and your experience from a strengths-based lens, or sort of leaning more towards strengths than weaknesses or faults and things, there was a higher chance of triumphing, you know, from that adversity, or it would be quicker.
Mm.
So then I started sort of, and also putting together, you know, what I was seeing in mediation rooms, the strengths-based approach that was, you know, that I was feeling, and then what I was starting to read about and hear about in the trauma-informed practice.
That's awesome. It's interesting you say that. I've noticed here in some of these parts, like in Switzerland, friends over there with kids and stuff in the schools. A friend was telling me actually that like the school, the test came back and it was only the mistakes that were highlighted. There was no focus on the ones that were right. It was like the test was actually, it was just like, this is what's wrong. And it kind of resonates what you're saying about like, you know, I'm somebody who's all for sort of leaning into the weaknesses or so on, but I'm also a firm believer on this. As you're saying with the adversity, like what has the experience offered you? What has it was as traumatic as it may have been? What has it given you? And I guess it's really kind of counterintuitive in a way when it's something that's potentially so difficult and adverse, but you know, coming out of that process, it's, you know, what has this given you to be able to like move forward and thrive from?
And the real challenge is that whether or not we find it, or how easy we find it to look towards our strengths, can also, well, is, you know, largely impacted by our early experience and essentially how we were taught to respond to stimulus generally. You know, and it might be that we may have had a, you know, super critical parent or even a perfectionist parent, because it can have the same impression on a child that, you know, I'm not good enough. Or so there's all these kind of small variables, I guess, that can impact how easy it is to look at the strengths. And I call on the strengths-based practice, their way of categorizing, you know, all thoughts, feelings, and actions as either coming under what's wrong or what's strong. Mm. So if you kind of use that, is my default, have I been taught to go towards what's wrong or what's strong? And sometimes there are different parts of our lives where we can go to the strengths quicker than others. And so there's no sort of magic formula. I guess for me, it's more about the reflection in looking at when, you know, the times that I have gone down the what's wrong path and looked at the weaknesses and blaming and fault and judgment and all that, how quickly was I able, or am I able to then flip that to then look at, you know, what are the lessons? What can I take from this? How has this helped me?
It's like flipping the narrative, which isn't easy to do. But I also think of, you know, validation. There's a lot of talk about, you know, not needing validation, and I understand that. But I also see the value in validation. Like, I'm somebody who actually needs it. I'm not like dependent on it, but I really thrive from it when I'm trying to do something and it's validated. But there is kind of this emphasis on, oh, don't seek validation.
Because we can benefit from that validation, because it's acknowledgement that we're on the right track, or, you know, what we're thinking or what we're doing makes sense. And, you know, that's important, I think, even for our own sense of self, because I interpret or view our sense of self as how much we believe in ourselves.
Mm.
That's how it's reflected. So anything that can contribute to how much we believe in ourselves is only going to help us. I guess the flip side there is then, is it how much do we rely on that? Then if we don't get that, then does that mean we can't believe in ourselves without that? And then we're dependent on that. So it's about getting to a point where we can be comfortable, you know, in ourselves, get that acknowledgement, but still, even if we don't get it, we can still continue.
Yeah, regardless of the validation, be independent of it in our own self belief. But you know, it clearly worked for you, as you were saying, when you went into that environment where it was strength focused, and it just sounds like you thrived from that. So
yeah, I definitely did, and that was really sort of the starting point, or one of the starting points for major transformation for me in my career, and also in me personally, because if, you know, I'm sort of in a situation where I'm receiving evidence that I'm on the right path, that, you know, I'm in a role where my strengths are acknowledged, appreciated, and not just in terms of from colleagues and managers, but I guess even clients, you know, you can see that, you know, their responses and things. And it's not that I couldn't have a career or personal growth without that, but for me at that point in my life, it was what helped me to then step in to really be comfortable with myself.
Yeah, that's huge.
Or more comfortable and accept, rather than trying to sort of fit what I think, or fit where I should go, or where maybe others sort of think I should go, because that's where I am in life and I need to be doing this. It just made it easier for me to believe in myself, because then if other people didn't believe in me, it didn't matter. Because I did, and I was going to pursue my goals or what was important to me.
Yeah, for sure. I imagine in the family mediation side of things, it's great that you're coming from that founder. You know, it's the kind of, I always believe this sort of get yourself right, and then the other things kind of fall into place rather than trying to focus on the external stuff. It's like, no, if you work within yourself and reflection, as you've mentioned, then the other stuff can. So the fact that you're helping people in these situations, I imagine there's quite a bit of empathy needed. I imagine like emotions are high. How do you deal with those more intense situations that people are trying to, or chaotic situations that people are trying to find a way within?
Yeah. Well, I think I'm naturally quite calm,
Mm.
you know. So for me to sit in a room where there's high levels of conflict, you know, it's not that it comes natural, but you know, it's something that I chose. So I knew that that's how it was going to be. And I think sometimes I sort of a little bit thinking, this is odd, because everyone always says to me, oh my gosh, how do you do that role? Isn't it this? Isn't it that? But for me, it's what I chose. Yes, it can be quite intense, because you're dealing with, you know, other people's emotions at one of their worst sort of, you know, life experiences. So it can be a challenge, and so I guess it's also about having a balanced lifestyle as well. And also my role as the mediator is not to take sides, it's not to judge, it's to be that neutral, you know, third party, with the exception of, you know, to be an advocate for the children who aren't, you know, necessarily in the room. But that's where it's my role to manage the process. So I've got an obligation to ensure that things don't get so heated that everything crumbles. I mean, sometimes it does, and you know, you can't always see things coming, but quite often, you know, you can see when someone's, you know, kind of had enough, and you can make procedural changes. Because I mean, being in a room, or even if it's virtual, with someone that, you know, you've decided you don't want to be with, you might not have been in the room with them for months, for 3 hours at a, you know, which is a normal duration of a mediation. So for sometimes it's the first time, and it's almost like a bit of an icebreaker then as well. So and it's also quite interesting for me to see that there can be several families with very similar circumstances, but extremely different outcomes and different ways of managing. And it also sort of goes back on to tendencies to look at what's wrong or what's wrong in that process as well.
Yeah, it must be reassuring for people in that environment to have a calm grounding force. And also, I imagine it would be common for people to go, oh, you're taking sides or whatever, but for them to see that you're objective and neutral but empathetic and grounded and so on. I think like many people, I'm someone who's really struggled with conflict, and it's a difficult one for me, but I've learned the importance of healthy conflict, and I've lent into that side of things. But that's always been a struggle, I think. I think many, I don't think it's that. I used to think, oh, maybe I'm just really oversensitive to conflict, but I think many people have struggles with it.
Yeah, because it's you know, it can be quite intense, and then depending on, you know, everyone's, I guess, background and scenarios and experience with conflict.
Yeah, but it must be really interesting for you to see, like you say, to see the ways people deal with it in different, you know, in their own different ways. That's fascinating.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Yes, and then I guess it got me curious about human behavior and why people respond certain ways and why others, you know, quite differently. And then looking at it from a trauma lens, then it helps me to reframe sort of behavior as, you know, instead of saying, oh, this, you know, I've got a behavioral issue or is a bit odd or quirky or whatever the case may be, then it became more about seeing that sort of behavior as a clue around their experience, because behavior is an adaptation to one's experience. So if you look at it that way, then it's like, well, there's something about that individual's past and early experience that taught them that that's the way to respond. So yeah, it's easier to just accept in non-judgment and also show compassion and empathy.
Yeah, human behavior is, I'm just fascinated by it every day. The quirks and you know, it's really, I'm very curious to it as well. Like what I've read about you as well. Like I'm a massive overthinker.
Yeah,
that's something that I'm continually working at, particularly creatively. I think I'm a bit better these days with the less. I'm much better these days, you know, the self-critique is quietened a bit just by doing it a long time and projects and things. Now I don't really have an issue in that sense, but I really can overthink things. So this is something you've also,
yes,
have.
yes, in many sort of situations. And
What are your overthinking thoughts on overthinking? Sorry.
Well, this is my definition then of overthinking, is that overthinking is an analysis of a situation, but so is reflection or self-reflection. They're both analysis of a situation, but they are kind of opposites. But when you look at overthinking, it's an analysis of a situation that focuses on what's wrong, you know, the weaknesses, what's at fault, the, you know, risks, you know, kind of the negative. Whereas if you look at more of reflection, it's more of an analysis of a situation that focuses on what's strong, the strengths, or the, you know, what could be the positives, what are the potential outcomes and learnings from that. So if you can do one, you can do the other. Sort of overthinking into more of a reflection, it's then about, well, how can I see this situation from a what's strong lens or a strength lens, and flip those, you know, negative assumptions and worries into, you know, what are the benefits? What can I learn from this?
That's very cool, because it's the same shift that you're talking about in your other work, in the focus on the strengths. So you're not saying don't try and think less, or don't be less analytical or be less reflective. You're essentially saying frame it in a different way and focus on the strengths in it. Because I think sometimes the overanalysis and the focus of what's wrong can overwhelm you and kind of stifle you in a way, but to the reflection has come up a bit on the show, actually. It's really that the value in realistic reflection, like it's come up, you know, sort of take reflection on things that have happened in the week, but also in a strength-based way, you know, what are the wins, and then what are the, maybe with a different ratio, like the wins to the stuff that hasn't worked, but yeah, also acknowledging what hasn't worked, but again, having like this positive approach to it. But I think that's really cool that you're essentially applying the same idea to that as well.
Yeah, because I kind of think that, you know, human behavior is quite complex, but also simple. You know, it's deep and complex, but we can, if we break it down in a very simple and sort of user-friendly way, I guess my hope is that then we can look at transforming that overthinking into something to maybe be ashamed of or to see it as a weakness and turn it into a strength, you know, by being able to see, okay, well, how has this helped me? You know, and I often think about, you know, the fact that because I'm an overthinker, then it takes me a while to make decisions sometimes when it's something that I'm not, like if I'm sure about it 100%, yes, I'll go straight ahead. But if it's something that, oh, I'm umming and ahhing about and I'm not sure and I'm asking a friend and I'm this and that, then to sort of flip that whole situation, I kind of thought, well, how has that helped me? You know, or what has been the benefit? What can I draw out of that? And I guess what I concluded is that, well, when I do make a decision, I really explore all the available options. I make an informed decision, you know, and then that sort of made it feel lighter for me. Then, yep, it's okay. I don't have to beat myself up for taking a long time to make a decision, because when I do, it's with confidence.
That's reassuring to hear that, actually, because I was going to ask, do you take time when it's time for a decision? And it's so important, because when people come at you with things and in the moment there's this pressure to make a decision, you don't have all the information you need. And it's okay to say, I appreciate it, I get back to you, you know, and then look at it in that reflective way. So that's yeah, that's, decision making is not easy often, but to.
That's right. I mean, even the small things and the big things as well. And I mean, I look at it as a mediator. I would always say to my clients, get legal advice, speak to your accountant, you know, get whatever, you know, sort of professional advice or information that will help them to be able to make an informed decision. So, well, why not? I do the same, yeah. You know, and not be ashamed or not see it as a weakness, even though maybe other people will say, oh, Rosemary, you take so long to make a decision. You know, it's like, well, that's me. That's what I'm going to do. And then I've sort of found that the more I flipped it into, well, I'm going to make an informed decision and it's going to be the best decision for me. And even if it's not, I'll learn something from it. So that's okay. The more I sat with that, then it actually became easier to make decisions because I felt confident. I knew that, well, what's the worst thing can happen? You know, these aren't, you know, life-threatening type of decisions that I had to make. So it helped the process easier. I mean, I need to buy a new bed and I have put that off because there's so many mattresses out there, but you know, I'll try to apply it there and just go to the store.
Yeah, I mean, any decision, no matter how big or small, can be kind of anxiety provoking and feel bigger than it is. Like you say, it's not, sometimes it's not life or death, but it kind of feels like it.
Because the focus is on what could go wrong.
Yeah, again. Generally, again. Yeah. Again, it's like, we seem to lean to like the disaster outcomes more easily than leaning towards the, I don't know what that is within us.
I think biologically, you know, we're primed to be on the lookout for threat. you know, and then we also have a negative bias. So biologically, we've got that. Then there's also our early experience and then genetics that can impact and all these other, these, you know,
factors,
experience and variables and our personalities, you know, is, you know, are we, you know, there are a lot of people who just are more sensitive than others generally. And so then they will take on a little bit more of the external world, and that might also impact things like decision making. So that's also part of it. And that was really highlighted to me working with families where there were several children, and, you know, there might be, you know, two that are, you know, managing really well with the separation, and one who's really struggling. And it could be developmental differences, but it could also be that that child was just more sensitive generally and more aware of, you know, everyone else's, I guess, situations and where positions and wanting to sort of balance everyone else and you know, not to upset this one or that one or whatever the case may be. And that was... I noticed that was a theme, that there were more and more sensitive children out there. I mean, there's a lot of research on it that, you know, I think it's about 25% of the population are more sensitive. So I guess for me as a mediator, then I think, well, is this sensitivity a biological thing, or is this a result of the experience that they've become like that because of their experience? Yep. So, and I don't, you mean I'm with their parents for a couple of hours, three, four, five, you know, so, but it adds to that sort of curiosity and also my gathering knowledge about, experience, human behavior and trauma. And I guess one of the main things about trauma that jumped out for me was that it's less about the event or series of events and more about the impact on an individual's quality of life, because you could have a, you know, a kind of average family, but for some reason there's one child who's absorbing everything in the same way that another child in an abusive sort of situation would, and responding, you know, and that could be sensitivity. It could be, you know, family conflict. I think sometimes family conflict is not seen as you know, potentially damaging as it can be, and a lot of people have just accepted conflict, and you know, there was this view that it was actually separation and divorce that could be harmful, but it's really the presence of unresolved conflict. And I mean, many of us know families who, you know, their parents, you know, probably should have separated, but they didn't, and there's heavy conflict, and you can see the impact that it's had on those children's sense of self, who, you know, might now be adults and then in their own relationships.
Yeah, so the ongoing conflict can potentially be worse than one significant breakup, because it's just longer exposure to this conflict.
And it's more about unresolved, because conflict is normal. But it's about how it's resolved. And from a child's perspective, you know, their parents are the most significant role models ever for them. So to see them in conflict and heavy conflict, and to know that they hate each other and that they show it and that they'll express it, you know, can be quite harmful.
Yeah, the parents are like the superheroes, and it kids take it on and stuff.
That's right.
How much does your intuitive radar come into play when you're dealing with these situations?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. I mean, I probably would not have said intuition several years ago, but now I guess I've starting to see things a bit differently and realizing, actually, I think that was, because I mean, if you look at intuition by definition, then it's kind of a knowing or an understanding that's not really based on fact. And the more I was in that role, then I was starting to see patterns that were just based on almost predictions of, well, this is what I've learned about human behavior. So if A plus B normally equals C, then I'm seeing A and B. Chances are C is going to happen. So sometimes it's about guessing as well, and also falling back on that we are adaptations of our experience. So our behavior is reframed as a clue to past experience. So then looking at it that way, you can start hypothesizing as well. I mean, even though I say my role is not to judge or not to take sides, but someone walks in, responds in a particular way, it will make me think about, you know, their experience. It might lead me to then ask, you know, or put a certain type of question to then see if there's anything that I could do to really support the process to make sure that, you know, they have what they need. It could be more breaks, or even holding a mediation in separate rooms, or slowing down the process, or saying, I want everyone to get legal advice, I want everyone to see a counsellor, or whatever the case may be. But yeah, definitely. But again, it's that because I'm an overthinker, you know, then sometimes something can present as intuition, but it's just overthinking, or also me interpreting what I've seen in the past and thinking, oh, it could be this too.
It's a tricky balance. And yeah, I think talking about intuition can sound a bit la-di-da or whatever, but I'm always fascinated in that intuitive knowing. Yeah. But like you say,
there's definitely been times where I will pursue a sort of line of thought or way of thinking. And in a lot of the mediations that I'm doing, there's always another mediator. So it's a co-mediated model. And even with the when I was working as a therapist, there'd normally be at least two. And there would often be times where my co-mediator would be, I could see that they're thinking, or they'd tell me after, I had no idea where you were thinking, where the heck were you going with that? And it just works, and you know, just go with it.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. It must be interesting to have the two perspectives of what happens, and that must benefit as well to have the two.
Definitely. Mm. Yeah, because sometimes, you know, being in the middle of someone else's conflict can be, you know, challenging, and also it can be a little bit tiring when you're, you know, so having someone else there, another mediator there, is good to help with the balance, and they might see something that I haven't picked up, you know, or I might see something that they haven't, you know, or I think it just works really, really well to help hold the room and the space.
It must be very satisfying for you to help navigate these situations. Like you say, sometimes maybe they just fall apart, they don't work. But when you find resolutions and things, it must be very satisfying.
Yeah, I think it can be very satisfying. I mean, and because, you know, you see people who come in and they're really worried and overthinking and unsure because there's so much uncertainty, you know, at that time. So to be able to just sit with them and see that they leave the room and they feel a little bit of relief.
Yeah, for sure.
But then again, at the same time, my role is quite sort of, I don't know if transitional is the right word, but it's just, I'm there for a few hours and then I'm gone. So I don't really know the full extent. I mean, unless they come back and say, we need another mediation, or which is quite, you know,
common.
And common. So yeah, better word, common. But often, you know, I don't really hear about how things are going. I mean, I can assume if they haven't come back, that could be good news, but I don't know.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's a tradition on the show to have guests offer some kind of challenge given their like personal experience or actually just given our discussion often. Is there anything that that springs to mind? I mean, we've touched on a few things, reflection, decision making, this shifting the focus to the strengths and the positivity. Is there something that springs to mind that the listeners can try in their daily lives?
Yeah, I think maybe just to think about, you know, scenarios, and particularly if there's been a stressful scenario, and it could be something like, you know, someone, you know, you're meeting someone and they're late, or you've lost your keys, or it doesn't have to be, you know, a major conflict, but maybe just think about that scenario and think about, well, what were my thoughts, feelings, and actions in that time? Would they come under what's wrong or what's strong? And then think about, well, if they're predominantly under what's wrong, how could I rewrite it? What would I be doing? What would I be feeling? What would I be thinking if that situation was rewritten under the what's strong lens?
Yeah, that's a good one. Reframe, no matter how big or small it is, just a reflection and a closer look at it, and like a reframe. So,
and yeah. I think also to be strengths-based with yourself in that process, you know, rather than just it's all about learning, and it's also about it's not about being going under what's strong the whole time, but you know, sort of realizing, hey, I was going to the what's wrong path, and it's worked for me in the past sometimes. Maybe now it's not working, or I want to try a different path. How can I rewrite that? And I guess the goal is, it's more about that reflection, and maybe that reflection time will get shorter and shorter, or will come smoother. It doesn't matter about the time, rather than being always on the what's strong. Because I notice a lot of people just talk about positivity and, you know, and sometimes it's just not, it's impossible. Yeah. Yeah. And then you beat yourself up because, oh, I'm not positive, or I'm not good enough because I'm not positive, you know. So it's more about what can you learn from your own experience, and how can you see the strength in that?
Where can people find you and your work?
So the best place would be my website, rosemarygattuso.com. And then there's also links there to my social media accounts, you know, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Facebook.
Also, yeah, I think I've realized that I've been looking at overthinking as perhaps like a weakness, but it's not. It can completely be a strength, you know. It's okay to be an overthinker.
Yep.
So yeah,
don't overthink it.
Being an overthinker, that's the yeah. So thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It's been lovely chatting.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.